From Santa Barbara, California, Timeless Voyager Radio with Bruce Stephen Holmes. Self-development radio for the open mind. Interviews with leading-edge authors and speakers in the fields of environmental issues, alternative health care, new psychology, psychic phenomena, UFOs, and extraterrestrial encounters. And now, Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio. My guest today is Amber Terrell. She's the author of Surprised by Grace, A Journey Beyond Personal Enlightenment. Amber says in her book, "Looking back, I would have to say that when I set out on the spiritual quest, I was not really looking for enlightenment. I was looking for personal improvement, personal fulfillment. I wanted to improve my mind, my personality, my body, my circumstances, and to fulfill the personal destiny of this life. In my search, I was led to very powerful and profound ways of doing this, but the true longing, longing for the eternal self, longing for real freedom, remained unfulfilled until this me, who was longing, dropped away. This is the irony," she says, "the great cosmic joke, the great secret of enlightenment. When the person who searches for enlightenment dissolves, then and only then is the object of the search revealed, having been obscured all along by the me who wanted it." Welcome to Timeless Voyager Radio.
Thank you.
Now you begin your book here on page 5, and I'm going to quote this, "Like a lamp in a windless place that does not flicker. This is how the Bhagavad Gita describes the mind of an awakened being. Released from the pangs of anger, fear, and envy, such a soul remains at peace in the midst of the world, unmoved by the endless polarities of the pairs of opposites, pleasure, pain, gain, loss, arrogance, worthlessness, acceptance, rejection, happiness, sorrow, and on and on. All this philosophy, you say, you understood so well, but philosophy and understanding had caused you to come to finally realize that they could not give you freedom. And let's start there. They couldn't give you freedom. Why is that?
Because the understanding was just in my mind. It was a mental understanding of that truth which I was longing for. And the understanding of it only made me want it more. The fact that I understood it so well only made me long for it more. But it wasn't being experienced, it wasn't being lived.
Now, so most people, I guess, and I myself included, have, and when I say most people, I mean most people that are, let's say, on this enlightenment search, so to speak, basically develop great vocabularies, they have incredible wisdom, but the bottom line is that the experience is eluding them, and I think that, and that's something that you were talking about in the book.
Yes, and there's a certain point where you're willing to say that, because, it's very easy to throw out the terms, you know. All is one. I am that. These kinds of truths, it's true that we are all one. It's true that that there's no separation. And when that is studied by the mind and then taken as a mental concept, it can actually be used to deflect from the fact that it is not being experienced. And as long as that deflection is fascinating you, and you know you're playing in that deflection, that's not possible to really directly inquire, who am I really? So my sense of the spiritual search is that it serves to a certain point. There's a certain point where a lifetime is turned from the things of the world, from gaining material wealth, material security, relationship, career, all the ways in which fulfillment is sought in the world. Somehow there comes a point where one turns from that and says, you know, it's not here. There's something I'm longing for that isn't here. And then often turning to the spiritual search and getting involved in that arena of acquisition. And it's the same acquisition. It's the same searching for something for me, to fulfill me. And when that search runs its course, which it did for me, that's the beginning of the book that you read, you know, the sensing, well, gee, I've been doing this for 25 years now and practicing all these techniques and understanding, studying all these things. And I still feel that I'm not living what I'm understanding. And one way that that actually appeared to me, I would say, and it's not in the book, but I was just thinking of a particular experience where I realized I'm not living what I think I'm living. I'm not living what I'm understanding. When I was with a young man who was a friend of mine, and we were both on a very, you know, intense spiritual journey and practices and study. We happened to be studying Thomas Merton at the time. And he was, we were both reading, you know, this book of his where he talks about feeling one with all of nature. One with looking at the flowers and seeing God's face. And we took a walk after this reading we did together, and we're just kind of reveling in this beautiful language of Thomas Merton, the beautiful expressions of oneness with all life that he was expressing, and just kind of reveling in that. And as we were walking along this path in this mountain retreat that we were at the time, a rattlesnake was sunning itself on the path in front of us and woke up as we got close, very close, and started his rattle, you know. And we both drew back in terror, our hearts pounding. And we looked at each other and said, where did the love go? And we realized that in that moment, realized that we'd been kind of mentalizing this oneness with all life thing. And in that moment of experience, we saw God's laughter in it, because he was showing us that we weren't living that. If we were living that, there wouldn't have been the fear, the extreme terror that kind of jumped out at us in that moment. We would have seen, oh, this too is God. And there was that moment of kind of shocking the mind out of its mentalizing of the truth that Thomas Merton was speaking to the reality of what we were experiencing. And the reality of what we were experiencing was that we were separate from this rattlesnake, and that rattlesnake was a threat to our life. And so it brought immediately us down into our own experience, our own direct, sort of, to tell the truth. What am I really experiencing here?
Now, it's interesting that you say in the book, and I really have to agree, that the mind even takes the concept of enlightenment and then makes it hers or his, so to speak.
Yes.
And that is the mentalizing you're talking about.
Yes.
The fact that the mind still wants to separate it, and that's why, let's say, in Zen they call it the pathless path. You can't want it, you can't get it. It always seems confusing to people when they first hear that, but the reality is what you say in your book. If the mind makes it into something, then it's not going to have the experience.
That's right. The mind cannot experience enlightenment. The The mind doesn't get enlightened. Let's put it this way. The mind does not get enlightened. The mind does not wake up. The person doesn't wake up. The person is a thought. It's a series, a whole layering of thoughts that one has created about the truth, about oneself. You know, I'm this tall, I have this kind of body, I wear these kinds of clothes, I have these kinds of friends, I have these kinds of fears, I have these kinds of strengths.
And it always starts with the word I.
Yes. This is the doll that you've made in your mind that you then identify with as being yourself. One of the ways that I begin off a lot of my talks when I speak to people is, you are not who you think you are. This is the message really from my teacher, Gangaji. You are not who you think you are. And this is something that doesn't have to be believed or taken on faith or memorized. It's something that can be investigated directly. And one of the things I do when I meet with people, especially people who've been on the spiritual search for a long time, is try to get them out of their heads with it and into what they are really experiencing in this moment. Because when I hear someone say, well, I know I'm all one, I know I'm one with everything, I know there's no separation, and yet I still experience such and such in my life, some suffering or something in my life. And I say, well, don't know those things. Forget all that. Forget that all is one. And just, you know, be willing to tell the truth about what is being experienced right now in this moment.
You're listening to Timeless Voyager Radio. My name is Bruce Stephen Holmes. My guest today is Amber Terrell. She's the author of a book called Surprised by Grace, A Journey Beyond Personal Enlightenment. Let's talk a little bit about Gangaji. Let's talk about how you met Gangaji and maybe a little bit about some of your surprises.
When I was, like as I said, I was on the spiritual search for some 26 years, actually. And in fact, it was 26 years to the day when I met Gangaji. 26 years that I had, since when I'd first been initiated into meditation practice and into this whole realm of spiritual search and spiritual practice. And I was having some depression that night about, gee, you know, 26 years, and I didn't get it, you know? I didn't get it. A friend of mine called, and she had been with Gangaji's teacher, H.W.L. Punja, Papaji, who he's called by his disciples. That's Gangaji's teacher. And this friend of mine had been with Papaji, and she said, you know, this lady who's a disciple of Papaji, you might like her. And she's coming to town, to Boulder, where I was living at the time. She's speaking tonight, and it's the last. She's actually been here for some weeks, and this is her last night. And I just had this thought that maybe you'd like to see her. I resisted her invitation at first because I realized, gee, you know, I'm really tired of hearing people talking about enlightenment. I've been hearing that for years, and it hasn't done me any good. Also, I was kind of tired of Indian stuff, and the name Gangaji conjured up a brown-skinned woman in a sari to me. I thought it was an Indian woman, and my friend never corrected that for me. But somehow I went with her to this lecture that day, and as Gangaji walked into the room, and I saw this American woman, white hair, looking very similar to myself, very similar age and size as myself, something stopped inside. I would say, now looking back, I can say that my mind stopped. At the time, I didn't know what it was that stopped. It seemed like the whole world stopped. There was not a thought that could arise in my mind suddenly. And I was just present. I was just there, in the room, in the presence of this woman and 200 or 300 other people, however many were there in that night. And I don't really even remember that much what she said that night. It wasn't even what the words that she was speaking. Something was emanating from her, some transmission of peace that was what I was looking for. And she was living it. not speaking it, not talking about it or pointing to it in some way. What I was experiencing was her transmission of it, that she was living it, and there was some transmission that was flowing out in the room, and it was received by me in a very deep way. And I can say for that hour and a half that I was sitting there with her, I forgot myself. I forgot the me who was looking for anything and was just sitting there in this stop, this gap, this emptiness, this peace. And then when she walked out of the room at the end of the talk, I just felt this incredible explosion of gratitude in my heart for her, not really understanding any of this, just the direct experience of peace and gratitude. So that was my first encounter with her.
Now, you had been with a number of learned or wise, should we call them gurus or teachers, for like you said, a quarter of a century. What do you think was the problem?
You know, I don't know. That's kind of a mystery, because I can't say that the people I was with before, the teachers I was with before, were not more... less enlightened or anything. I mean, I remember when I first met Amici, beautiful Indian woman. She walked in the room, and I said, "My God, this is God." I felt I was seeing God in her. I mean, she obviously an incredibly awakened being. And Maharishi Mahesh Yogi was with for many years, and also just the transmission from him was awesomely beautiful. And yet, somehow, it took seeing that in a form that was so much like me that it could not be denied anymore that was my own self that I was seeing. Because I'd always seen the teachers I'd been with, I'd always seen them as someone else. That person enlightened, that person radiating God, that person radiating peace or darshan or whatever, separate from me. When I saw Gangaji, that experience ended. It wasn't like there was any separation anymore. It wasn't like me and her. The separation was ended. And I realized when I met her this way and recognized what had taken place, that the separation had vanished. That is what the true meeting with the teacher is. It's not a person meeting a person. It's not a person at the feet of a person. It's the mind at the feet of the self. It's the mind in surrender to its source. That's the metaphor of teacher and student. Mind in the surrender to itself. Its source. And in that, you don't... to truly experience guru or teacher or master, there's not an experience that I'm a person and she's a person and we're having this relationship. The separation is somehow annihilated in the meeting with the true master. Someone had asked me recently in a talk in Ojai, California, what is this relationship with the master? What is this thing that happens? And what I said to them, and I'll just speak it out because I think it was probably the clearest I've ever said it. It's like a wave on the ocean is going around splashing, playing, having a good time, playing with dolphins, and suddenly it has the desire, I'd like to know my source. I've heard that my source is the ocean, but I am not experiencing that. So it goes in search of its source, and maybe some wise waves tell it, well, you know, it's the ocean, that's who you are. It says, yes, I know, I heard that, but I want to experience that. I haven't experienced it. I just understand it, but I haven't experienced it. So maybe it goes on a long search, but finally, out of some mysterious compassion for a minuscule part of itself, the entire ocean rises up in a single wave and says, look, hi, this is you. And the little wave goes, my God, it's myself, but looking like a wave, looking like what it thinks it is, but actually radiating what it really is. And that's really the experience when I met Gangaji. I saw someone who looked like what I thought I was, a woman, you know, in the early 50s, late 40s. I think I was 48 when I met Gangaji. She was about 52. Looking about my size, shape, and age. Looking just like me. Talking just like me. But radiating what I really was. Looking like what I thought I was, but radiating what I truly was. And so somehow that's what, that mysterious transmission was what broke through the illusion of myself as who I thought I was.
Now, a lot of people think that you have to go through years and years and years and years of preparation before this can happen, and yet I think, as I recall in the book, Gangaji says it can happen in an instant.
Yes. And I have an example which I will give, which can illustrate that. I have a friend who became my friend as when he came out of prison. He actually had been in prison for 18 years. He'd robbed banks, he'd blown up power stations, he'd been on the 10 most wanted list in the United States. He was a hoodlum of the grandest order. He was put in prison in Colorado, and somehow Gangaji came and spoke at that prison one day to some prisoners there. I think 15, 20 men, not a big group. And he saw her and woke up to the truth of his being. He saw himself so powerfully as he had never seen himself before and realized that all the story of his life, the story of John as a bank robber and as a prisoner and as all the things that he thought of himself, somehow ended, and he saw himself as he truly is in her eyes. And he got out of prison just about a year and a half ago or so, and he is now speaking this in a very beautiful way. He's telling his story of how he woke up. And this was someone who had never meditated, who'd never read a spiritual book, really, before that. He wasn't spiritually inclined. He actually even used to tell people who... There was a video group there at the prison that used to watch Gangaji's videos, and he used to tell them, he says, you're wasting your time. He says, the Buddhists have been doing this for years, and you really have to work for it. You can't just wake up like she says you can. And he was actually trying to tell people that she was lying and she was a fraud. But in the meeting with her, everything stopped. All his thoughts about it, about enlightenment, about himself, about anything, just stopped. And he woke up. So it really was quite amazing to a lot of people who, like myself, had been meditating and doing yoga and fasting and doing all these penances for enlightenment. And here's this man whose practice had been robbing banks and blowing up, actually environmental terrorism is what he was involved in for a while. That was his practice. See, we're all practicing. We're all practicing something. And these practices are all of the mind, whether they're called spiritual practices or whether they're called practices.
Antisocial behavior.
or social behavior, or getting ahead on Wall Street, or whatever. Whatever kind of practices, these are the practices of the mind, for the mind to get strategies of mind, for the mind to get what it thinks will fulfill it. And all these practices ultimately have to stop for you to see that what you are practicing in order to get, what the strategizing in order to get, is actually who you are all along, who you've always been. And all this work of the mind, whether it was spiritual work or worldly work or hoodlum work, was overshadowing just kind of over the busyness that overlooked the fact that who you are is already free, already fulfilled, needing no experience for its fulfillment.
But you would agree that the mind is very cunning, right?
Very cunning.
And I mean, the bottom line is that this sounds like, oh, that's all you have to do, but that's not all you have to do. This is not like, I mean, when you say it can happen, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of surrender or stopping, as Gangaji puts it, which for many people is practically impossible.
Yes, and when I was speaking in Seattle recently, there's a Unity Church where I speak there, and there's a very beautiful embossed gold or brass embossed saying over the wall there in back of me in this little chapel where I speak, and it says, "Be still and know that I am God." And I say when I speak there at this chapel, I always say to those people, I said, this sounds like a very innocent kind of invitation, doesn't it? Be still and know that I am God. But I'm telling you, this being still is very ruthless. It's a ruthless invitation. Because to be still, you have to stop everything that you're doing, all the practices. And the practices are simply what you're reaching for and what you're pushing away. It's as simple as that. But it's not so simple when you are invited to stop, in that you really want what you're reaching for, and you really don't want what you're pushing away. So to stop pushing that stuff away, you have to let it come. But in the moment of stop, the invitation is to let everything come that you've been pushing away, including unenlightenment, if that's what you've been reaching for. And let everything go that you've been reaching for, that you've been wanting, that you've been trying to get. When you're willing to let everything go that you want, and let just in a moment, just in an instant, to let everything go that you want, and let everything come in that you hate, that you are terrified of, in that moment, the mind can rest, because its job has ended. Because the mind's job is to reach for what it wants, to push away what it doesn't want. So in the moment of the willingness to just stop, you're willing to not have what you want and to have all that you don't want. You're willing in that moment just to let everything be as it is. And that's a very powerful moment in a live stream. And for myself, I can say that the willingness to really stop somehow came in the presence of meeting Gangaji, because she was stopped. So she radiates that stop. Her willingness is so ruthless to just be still in every moment.
Now, you basically had quite a problem as far as your relationship with her was concerned, because you describe in the book the fact that you literally became dependent or attached, I guess, without even realizing that it happened.
That attachment was not a problem. The attachment with the teacher is the greatest blessing of a lifetime. The attachment is no problem. The only problem, and where I would get into suffering with it, which I describe in the book, is when I would try to somehow control her. To have some control over how she was treating me, or what she was, you know, when she was noticing me, or what she was giving me that I might want or not want. That tendency to want to control the relationship was the problem.
Yeah, and I mean, you basically say that again, here we are back with the mind. The mind has a preconceived notion and a set of parameters that make it very, very exciting to be dwelling on the idea of enlightenment, as long as it fits within those parameters.
Yes.
As soon as it moves outside of the parameters, or is, as you're saying, uncontrollable, then the mind doesn't want any part of it, because it's not part of what it's expecting to happen.
That's right, and it freaks out, and it wants to start controlling and manipulating again. And that, when I found, that's the mind arose again then. Once, after the first initial stopping with her and awakening to myself, there was an arising again of the mind for a strategy to keep her like I wanted her. And she, being a very true teacher, was not willing to play that game. She just is not controllable. Thankfully, she's not controllable. So
couldn't be controllable, even not just by you, but by anything, since right. She's not part of the mind game.
No, she isn't.
I mean, and I think if I were to look at this thing, let's say, from the mind's point of view, the bottom line here is that, in general, you've got the world operating in a mind game, and those people who are quote-unquote enlightened are not playing the mind game. That's what makes them different.
That's right. That's why they're so terrifying to the mind. As I mentioned in the book, when I first met her, I fell in love with her, deeply, deeply in love with her. And then long about the first few, I think it was maybe the first or second week with her. No, actually, it was the first few days with her. She walked in the room one day, and I was terrified of her. There was a terror that struck into my heart, and I realized, my God, she's going to kill me. And I realized in that moment how uncontrollable she is. Because in this moment of being still, of actually being willing to stop so totally.
Let's go back and define for the listeners what you meant by being killed.
Being killed?
Because, I mean, obviously, I read the book. I'm real familiar with what you're saying. I mean, this is death. This is the ego. This is what the ego is striving to not have happen.
That's right. That's what all the activity of mind does not want to happen. That's what all the reaching for what you want and pushing away what you don't want is the goal of, is the survival of this I that you think yourself to be. In the meeting with the true master, that terror, you will feel that terror. That's how you know it's real. That's how I knew this was really the master, because I knew I was over. And the I that I thought I was terrified by that. It knew it was its game was up, kind of thing. And there was a terror that arose. But fortunately, the attachment to her, the love with her, was so strong before that I couldn't move, even in that terror. There was not the ability anymore to run from her. And there was the impulse a few times. I would say the impulse arose many times after that. But because she is ruthless in her uncontrollableness and in her ruthless slaying and exposing of the habit patterns of mind and the tendencies of mind and the strategies of mind, all the things you never wanted to see about yourself will become clear.
Now, people don't understand this when they first start out. I mean, as you pointed out, and as I read from the end of your book there, you know, people are real happy to improve themselves, quote-unquote, improve their mind, have nice things happen, make their body look better. They have all these preconceived notions that preserve the I.
Yes.
What they don't ever think about is that enlightenment has nothing to do with that thing.
That's right.
Now that is very terrifying. Now before we go any farther, Amber Terrell is my guest. The book is called Surprised by Grace, and frankly, folks, I read it. I love the book, and I certainly urge you to read it. I promised you, Amber, that we could have a half hour interview, or if you wanted to continue, we could continue. So I kind of want to take this moment to say to you, if you want to continue, great. If not, then we'll take a few minutes to kind of sum it up. Your choice.
Let's continue.
Okay. You're also a musician. As a matter of fact, I have a CD of yours that you sent, and it's kind of interesting. I think I'll let people know. You and I actually had kind of a meeting back around 1972. I don't know what you remember about that, but a friend of ours or a friend that we both share gave me a tape of one of your songs, groups of songs that you had written back in 1972.
Yes.
So you have the CD. What is the name of the CD for our listeners?
Awaken from a Dream.
All right. With that in mind, we were talking about this, and this is a great reason for using the word illusion. Certainly one of the illusions is that enlightenment somehow satisfies the needs of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And you say it doesn't. So continue and tell us about the ruthlessness that is apparently there waiting for us.
Well, we were talking about the attachment to the teacher And also, you were you mentioned how the mind is very wily, and often I see people that they meet Gangaji, they just fall in love, they think it's wonderful, and then they say, Gangaji, just really be ruthless with me, and I really want, you know, to receive everything from you, and just be real ruthless with me, and I want to be your student. And as soon as the sword comes out, as long as she's giving them flowers, they're happy.
Yeah,
the sword comes out.
One slap.
They're out the door, you know. Hey, this isn't what I had in mind. I wanted the flowers. I wanted to have this love affair with this beautiful teacher. And hey, what's going on here, you know? So I've seen this happen many times. I've seen my own mind want to run many times.
Why don't we give a couple pragmatic examples of the sword? I think it's good for the listeners to hear this. You wrote some great examples, so why don't you take your choice and just give them something that they can really get their teeth into?
Well, when I first met Gangaji, she encouraged me to sing. I was kind of a closet songwriter before I met her. I rarely performed anything. I occasionally did for friends or for small gatherings, but very, very occasionally. And when I did, I usually was a basket case before, during, and after in terms of being nervous, and I was just too shy to really be a performer. But I did write music, and when Gangaji found out that I wrote music, she would have me sing in front of the gatherings, the satsang gatherings. Satsang is what we often call this coming together in truth. Satsang means association with truth. So she would often have me play, and there was, you know, 200 or 300 people there often. So she really showed me that this all nervousness that I had was all in my mind and in the emptiness that she pointed me to. The songs could flow out quite effortlessly in front of a large group. So she had me singing a lot, and she basically would kind of praise me a lot for my music and just, you know, kind of her favorite singer for a while. And then she began to, you know, sort of not praise me as much and praise other people for their singing, and almost sort of saying that I wasn't, you know, such a great singer, and just kind of...
So you kind of had like a falling from grace, or...
Yeah, kind of showing, you know, there was such a joy when she was praising me so much for it. And then, like, for instance, one day I wrote a song for her that she'd asked me to write. It was really the first one that she had said, oh, we should have a song about Happy to Be Here. And that was in a particular satsang in Maui. And I said, oh, so I went home and I wrote a song called Happy to Be Here. And then I brought it to satsang the next day, and I put a note up on her chair saying, I have a song about Happy to Be Here. I'd like to sing for you. And I was all excited about singing this song for her, that she was kind of proud of the fact that I'd written this song for her that she'd asked me to write. And she said, oh, Amber wants to sing a song? Okay. So she had me sing the song, and as I was singing the song, she had someone else come up to the front, and she was talking with them the whole time and completely ignoring this song that I was so proud of that I'd written for her. And I was just mortified that in front of everyone, she had kind of, I felt, slighted me, that she had really kind of ignored this song that I'd written. And I felt a lot of things arise in my heart about, gee, hey, she's dangerous. You know, she kind of coaxed me out of my closet of singing, not, you know, being a closet songwriter, and got me singing in front of people, kind of got me excited about being the performer and being the favorite singer and all this. And then she cut the cord. And that actually continued and got even more ruthless. She actually had me sing on one group. She had a friend of mine sing that she praised the song and said, oh, it's so beautiful, so beautiful. And then she had me sing, and while I was singing, she left the room. She left. And things like that, she would do things like that to show me where I was still identified with myself as someone, as some person who had these particular emotional needs and needed to be kind of treated in a certain way.
Now,
I was still trying to control her in that way.
Yeah, I want to just stop for a second. Now, you know, this is where I have to say, and certainly you disagree with me if you want, but somewhere along the line, all of your past training at least allowed you the privilege of questioning what was going on. There are other people who could not have gotten but past the image or the illusion of what seemed to be going on. I mean, I've got to say that somewhere along the line, all of the work that you did would allow you to be in a place where you could at least accept this and work with it. Because not everybody is going to see what you saw.
You know, I can't really say that all that I had studied helped me in this at all. Because I know a lot of people that have studied this as much as I have and understand it as well as I do.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that.
And there wasn't the ability to stay.
Actually, that's not what I wasn't clear. I guess what I'm trying to say is that since you said it so well in the book, you said after 26 years, you felt like you had wasted your time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see what you mean.
At this point in your life, you're saying to yourself, I'm going to stick through this thing. I don't care because it's obvious that nothing else that I've ever done has worked. I guess maybe that's clearer. I don't know if that's better, but that's what I think I was trying to say.
Yeah, that actually I could say that is how it served. That I had tried everything, and I knew there were no more things to try. And there was one point when Gangaji actually made me her assistant for a while. She let me be her assistant, and I just loved doing that. And then she fired me from being her assistant.
That's great.
And, of course, I hated that, you know. And she really has been quite ruthless and still continues to be with giving me every... There's actually one song that I wrote recently that's not on the album yet. It'll be on the new album that is coming out soon. Which said, the line in it says, "You are my dream come true, and you are my hanging cross. You are the sweetness that remains after all is lost." And really what she does is she gives you everything that you've ever wanted, and then she takes it all away. So that you can see that none of that has anything to do with who you are. And people, of course, love to get everything they want when they first meet her. And they, of course, hate having everything taken away. And I see that the mind does not like that. The mind does not want that. And we'll think of very clever ways of slipping away from that. And there's a lot of people teaching right now. There's a lot of teachers available in the United States. And what I see people do is go from one to the other, looking for the honeymoon, looking for the one that'll give them everything they want. And then as soon as that teacher starts taking things away, they go to another teacher to get everything they want. Another teacher.
Reminds me of the way people have relationships.
It's exactly like that. It's promiscuity in the field of guruship.
Very interesting word.
It's promiscuity. It's not being true to what you're there for. Which is to burn up the impulse to identify yourself with this person that needs things.
And once again, this is the mind. This is the mind's controlling factor. This is what the mind wants. It's like the game.
Yes.
You want enlightenment as long as it fits into the parameters.
Yes. That's it. You want it in your own terms. And definitely by the time I met Gangaji, I'd sort of gave up that I could ever get this, you know, with any way that I could do it. I really had given up that there was any way that it could be gotten somehow by me. And in meeting her, I recognized this is the self, this is the true teacher. This is what I've been longing for, and it's also what I've been running from. And then you're willing to stop.
Now, it used to be taboo for a person to announce their level of whatever it is, consciousness. I don't know what it is. I don't mean that in a derogatory manner. I mean, I actually don't know what it is anymore. They used to have names for the different levels of consciousness, and I can't even get straight on what they are anymore. But the point I'm saying is that it seems almost well, it doesn't, oh, there's, I can't even say it the right way. It's just different to have somebody come out and say, look, I did it. It's just, what can I say? I can't think of any other way to say it. I'm not questioning whether you've done it or not. You know what I'm saying? And as a matter of fact, to be perfectly honest with you, you know what I've said to many people is, actually, I don't care where other people are. I'm the one I'm concerned about.
The truth is, there isn't anyone else.
But and you're right, and that's right, and I understand that, and I live that way. But for the sake of listeners, and a lot of people are you know, true seekers. They really, really want something, and they're listening, and they're saying, okay, I see what the problem is. I know what I have to do. Okay, well, if somebody's sitting back there and they're saying, I know what I have to do, what would you say at that moment? What do they have to do?
Nothing. They have to stop doing what they're doing and see, truthfully, what it is that they're doing.
Now, be specific.
Okay.
Give us some examples.
Okay. There is no how to stop. The how is what you're doing. You see what I mean? Stopping doesn't have a how associated with it. The how is how you're moving, how you're reaching for this and pushing away that. And so I would say that it's useful, and what I say to people when I speak in different places, I suggest that people just examine, what am I reaching for, and what am I pushing away, and then see if there's a willingness to just stop reaching for that, stop pushing away this, just for a moment, and see what is here, already here.
In the book, you gave a great example. I think it was with your husband, who, after explaining all the things that he was striving for, it came down to recognition. Right? I think that's how I remember it. I mean, am I off on the wrong...
Say that again. I wasn't quite...
Somewhere in the book, I remember, I think your husband was just being introduced to... well, not being introduced, but I guess, in a sense, surrendering to your need or to your want of being with Gangaji.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was a little bit of a conflict where he had things he wanted to do. He was going to school, so on and so forth. And I think the question that came up was, what was he striving for? And then as I remember in the book, he basically, after a few minutes of investigating, realized that all he was really striving for was recognition.
Yes, this is telling the truth.
Right. And so this is an element in this practice, too, of actually finding out what the truth is for you.
Yes, and that's a ruthless sort of self-investigation that can take place. What do I really want? And everyone knows what the right answer is. I want enlightenment, I want truth, I want peace for all beings. But to really, really look at what is your life about, what motivates the things that you push away and the things that you reach for, what is that motivation there? And then to just see it.
Because the mind is always lying about that, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Because the mind
is a huge liar.
Because the mind is always saying, oh, I really don't want this for myself. I want it for others. Right? I mean, that's what the mind would say.
The ego is absolutely selfish.
Right. That's
absolutely
what,
selfish.
So
and
the mind
has
is...
ways of covering that.
Well, I'm saying the mind is so cunning, it's fantastic. I mean, it can come up with an answer for everything.
Yes. Recently, someone asked me talk I was giving, how can you... The person was very clearly seeing how wily their mind was, how it could circumvent and how it could take any amount of truth that it realized and then take that into the mind and use it somehow for survival of the ego. And I said, this is true seeing. This is exactly what the mind does. And they said, well, how can that be circumvented? And I said, this love. Love, the heart is what, in my experience, the heart is what circumvented the mind. But the fact that I fell in love with Gangaji so deeply that I had to listen, I could not run anymore. I had to stop.
I mean, people who are not really familiar with what we're talking about could say that that was quite an abusive relationship. or is quite an abusive relationship.
Especially
they, from your side of it, you sound like this, and I'm being very frank, you sound like this very weak person who is being abused by a very strong person. That's what it sounds like on the surface.
Well, if you look at this relationship as a person and a person, you could maybe look at it that way.
Well, I'm not saying it is that way. I'm just
saying. But it's not a person and a person. It's the mind surrendering to the self.
And I see that.
The mind in surrender to itself. And certainly if a person surrenders to a person in the way, this kind of way, and there's many examples, you probably know some yourself, of teacher-student relationships that have been abusive, that have been some misuse of power involved. And when the one that's acting as teacher is not fully in alignment with self, is not fully empty, is not true to the truth totally, then that possibility does arise. Fortunately, this explosion of love that took place for me was with a true teacher, a teacher who does not move, does not believe for one moment that you are separate from her.
Let's define the term move, because there are a lot of people who have not read the book.
Moving means moving toward and moving away, moving in the mind, moving toward reaching for something for me.
Now you say that, because you've said it a number of times. You've said, and you've said it so many times I can't even remember it. But going towards, pushing away, the mind is always trying to put itself into a comfortable place, right?
That's right.
So if there's something that it thinks will make it more comfortable, it goes to get it.
Yes.
If there's something that seems like it's making it less comfortable, it's pushing it away.
Yes, and elaborate layers of strategies for doing both are developed from birth. From the time you start crying for food or crying for attention as a child, you begin to build the strategies for this kind of comfort. And different people have different strategies, and different people like different things, you know.
Sure.
So people have very unique sets of strategies. But these strategies are what then get applied to the spiritual path when you meet the teacher or you meet God. They get applied to God. You want to get what you want from God, and you want to get away from what you don't want from God or from the teacher. So the strategies are then applied to the spiritual path as well. And that is what a true teacher will bust you on, because that doesn't work. That is also strategy. That's just strategy.
So
even
that's
it
what
looks spiritual,
right.
It's just strategy.
So move is that. And
yes,
stopping
using strategies.
And stopping is not that.
Right. Stopping is the letting go of all the strategies, and moving is using the strategies.
So now when a person wants to do this type of self investigation what is it called actually? There's probably a correct word for it.
Self-inquiry.
All right.
What
are the kinds of letting go? I mean that is such an easy thing to say,
mm-hmm.
and such an easy thing to pretend to be doing.
That's right.
So, what is the real letting go? How is that done?
I don't know. It's grace. That's why I titled the book "Surprised by Grace," because when I met Gangaji, somehow everything stopped. And that was the grace. I didn't do anything. I suddenly just stopped when she walked in the room. And my take on that is just because she is so completely still. She radiates the stillness, but somehow I was able to catch it. It was catching. So, from my perspective, in my experience, and some people have caught it from me.
Right, and I've heard this. So the real issue here is that for some particular reason, still in this day and age, there is a need for that physical contact.
With
something,
the teacher?
Yeah, somebody has to be there. Or I don't want to put the words out. I'll put it into the form of a question. Does someone have to be there to impart to you something that is not of the mind? That you use the word grace, I mean, whatever anyone wants to call it, being zapped, whatever it is, somewhere along the line, there is a, what, a third thing that needs to happen? Is that, I don't even, it's still not a question.
You know, I know some people, I know there are some people that have woken up to the truth of themselves and stopped completely without a physical teacher being present. Ramana Maharshi, who's the teacher of Papaji, he was 16 years old, and he just had the fear of death arose one day, and he just decided to lay down on the floor and say, okay, what is this? What is death? Who dies? And investigate this fear of no survival, of death of the mind, really, was what he was investigating. And he woke up so completely that he, for many years after that, hardly ever spoke. He just sat in silence and bliss. And people came and sat in his presence, but he didn't even know they were there. They would just come to sit with him because it was radiating such incredible peace and joy and silence. He didn't have a human teacher. And there are examples of that I know here in the West, where people have just suddenly woken up, suddenly stopped.
But it's nice to have somebody to do something, or to at least help you. In like training wheels on a bike or something.
What I would say is, I would never propose to say, gee, you need a teacher or you don't. But my experience is that I did. That I had to have a form that looked just like me, that was very similar to myself, somehow, that worked with me in the way that Gangaji worked with me. I needed that. It wasn't possible for me without that. Gangaji says the same about her experience with meeting Papaji. She said, I needed to have a teacher, guru, stop me in the way that he did and work with me in the way that he did. That was essential. Papaji was 8 years old when he woke up. But he spent many years of his life searching for somehow a way to make it permanent. And he went from teacher to teacher to teacher to ashram to ashram to ashram. He was a saint from a very young age. He was able to manifest Krishna, not only for himself but for others. Show people Krishna. Vision of God. A very incredible being. And yet, it wasn't until he met Ramana that he fully realized that there's no place, you don't have to reach for this, you don't have to reach for God. God is right here.
Now you say it very well in the book. There's power and there's freedom.
Yes.
We have a lot of people searching for power right now.
Yes.
But power does not bring freedom.
No. Personal power has nothing to do with freedom. Personal power is what's called a siddhi. In Sanskrit, it's called a siddhi, a yogic power, they call it. And we all have powers of all the strategies that we have are siddhis. They're powers of mind.
So once again, it's all in the mind.
It's all in the mind. There's a beautiful story where Papaji is walking along the river Ganga, the holy river up in the Himalayas, and he's on a pilgrimage, and he meets this beautiful old yogi there who has a staff, a beautiful carved staff, and the yogi says, they meet and they have a meal together, they kind of like each other, they sit down together that night by the Ganga and have a meal, and the yogi says, you know, my master gave me this beautiful staff, and my master was a great siddha. He had all the powers, and the yogic powers. He gave me all these powers. He gave me the staff, which is the power of immortality. I will not die like other men. He also gave me... And Papaji says, well, show me what you can do. And the yogi says, okay. So he levitated off the ground, and he became invisible, and he showed Papaji some of his powers. And then the yogi said, but you know, you have what I want. You have this peace that I want. My master said, I gave you all these powers. He said on his dying breath, he said to me, I've given you all these powers, but I could not give you freedom because I don't have that. I just have these powers. But you will meet someone who will give you this freedom. And when this yogi met Prabhupada that night, he said, I know you're the one my master told me about. Will you give me this freedom? And so the yogi said, and so Prabhupada said, well, how bad do you want it? And he said, I want it with everything I have. And so Prabhupada says, okay, give me the staff. The staff of immortality that the yogi had. So he gave Prabhupada, he sort of hesitated a moment and then gave Prabhupada the staff. And Prabhupada broke it over his knee and threw it in the Ganga. He says, there, now you will die like other men. And they sat there in silence, meditating. And finally the yogi opened his eyes and laughing and just in total joy and said, thank you, thank you, thank you. And he prostrated at Prabhupada's feet and said, I will serve you the rest of my life. And Prabhupada says, no, I don't need anyone to serve me. Go and live your life in freedom. And Gangaji told this story when I first met her, and it really affected me very deeply because I was on a path, as you know, Bruce, where I was studying the yogic powers and wanting to get the yogic powers. And that story just somehow woke me up, shocked me awake to the truth that these powers also are just in the mind. They come and they go. Even the power of immortality. So what? Even the earth itself passes away eventually.
Very, very, very well said.
But what is here? What is here always? What doesn't come and go? With the coming and going of bodies, with the coming and going of strategies of mind, powers, with the coming and going of planets, with suns being born and suns disappearing in the heavens, what doesn't come and go, what all that arises in, to know that that is who you are, that is the ultimate freedom. And that's what Gangaji radiates, what she speaks and points to with every word that she speaks, and what she will push you deeper and deeper into if you open to her.
I couldn't have thought of a better way to finalize the show. That was perfect. What else can I say? You know what? We used to always joke, though, you know, like, well, now, so after that, what's next?
And you can't say that now, can you?
I can. So after you've accomplished that, then what do you do?
Why do you need to know that?
I don't know. You're being right. That's right. That's great. That's great. There was the mind.
You
the mind's question.
Recognize that and then tell us.
That's great, though. I really appreciate it. What a great story. What a great book. Amber Terrell, the book is called Surprised by Grace, A Journey Beyond Personal Enlightenment. And I'll tell you, if you didn't get it now, you're not going to have a chance. What's next for you besides your teaching now and your traveling, I guess?
Well,
what would you like to do, or what is? I know that's not the right question. So,
there's the life that Gangaji invited me to when I first met her. She invited me to a life that doesn't look like anything, and I didn't quite know what she meant back then. She invited me she invited me to be no one at all. And to live a life that looked like nothing. And I said, oh yeah, sure, yeah, I want that. But I didn't really know what that was then. And now what I find the push into is into this life that you cannot get a handle on what it looks like. Like one of my friends recently said, oh yeah, you know, this is so great, you know, you have this book out and you're traveling around, you're speaking, and I said, yeah, but if I start believing that I have this book out and I'm traveling around speaking, I'm dead in the water again. I'm This is just the thought of it again. The true life cannot be thought, and it can never be known how I'm serving or what it looks like. You can kind of look backwards sometimes and see, but I never know what is next. If I start knowing what's next, that's back in the wanting to control it, wanting to somehow be in charge again, having the mind be in charge. The mind is continually being slain. It arises, yes, but it continually is slain. I said to Gangji recently, you watch every thought as it arises, and if I reach out to touch it, I am slain. I is no match for you. And this is a life in surrender to the master, the mind in surrender to the self. And when I say you, when I say to Gangaji, what you watch every thought, I mean this that one is, the self, this hugeness, this unknowable freedom, unspeakable freedom. That's what I mean by you, because that's how it appeared to me. It appeared as Gangaji. For someone else, it may appear in some other way, but it appeared for me as her. So forever, that freedom has this flavor of her to it. That's the mystery of master, the mystery of teacher and disciple. It's not a person and a person. It's the mind constantly, for till the last breath, surrendering itself to its source.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bruce.
What a great interview. I really just appreciate the fact that you took the time to do it. Again, as I said before, I really enjoyed the book. As a talk show host, it's rare that I ever do more than just scan the book, as you were so surprised that I actually read it. But you have a very compelling style, and it's easy. And it's not filled with a lot of stuff, a lot of BS. There was a lot of good material in there, and I appreciate that. And it just shows that your teacher has done well with you. And the rest of us...
She will say she didn't do anything.
And the rest of us will envy you until we get rid of our mind. So, with that... Thank
the
you so
mind
much.
Doesn't have to be gotten rid of.
Well, you know, I was gonna.
It
I don't,
doesn't have to be gotten rid of.
That I was gonna start that, but that's another. show.
It just has to not be believed to be real.
Yeah.
To be believed as who you are, then it's no problem with the mind arising.
Yeah.
No problem with planets and worlds. And
it must
sun.
Be. There must be a purpose for it. It's just way out of its domain.
It's not what you think. But it reveals itself.
All right. Thanks, Amber.
Thank you, Bruce.
We will talk soon.
Okay.
All right. What an incredible interview. Boy, I tell you what, I'm so happy that I was able to do this. I looked forward to it. Thanks for listening, and more soon. Remember, the knowledge is timeless, and you are the Voyager.